Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of America's Conservative Podcast. I am your host, Ed Denzel. The days continue to be beautiful here in Madeira Beach, Florida. Definitely going to get out and play some disc golf today, throw the discs a little bit. Hopefully, I'll be ready. A week and a half from now, I have a one-day tournament up there in Floral City at a course that I haven't played. I was talking to my dad yesterday. I don't think I've played that course since 2014, I think. It seems like yesterday, but it's a really nice course. I wish it was closer. I'd play there even more, but it's like about an hour and 45 minutes away. But I think I'm going to drive up there this weekend and get a little practice in because on April Fool's Day, I have a tournament, a one-day tournament up there that I hope to play well in. And I have been throwing well recently, so my expectations are that I will play well. But I just haven't played that course in almost 3 years. And I've played that course well. I think I've done okay on that course, considering everything. It's a course that I've shot well on, and it's friendly to lefties. So hopefully April 1st, I'll do well. And it looks like there's going to be plenty of weather for me to practice in, which is nice. I forgot to tell you about a story that happened Monday night. A little funny, kind of funny. I live here on 140th Avenue in Madeira Beach. And there is a – right across the street right out in front of my street, there's like a T intersection. So there's a street that comes at just a little bit of an angle that heads toward my front door. And so there's a stop sign, and then there's 140th Avenue going by my place, and I forget what the name of the street is that is right pointed right at my place. Well, on Monday night, I'm sitting there doing whatever I was doing Monday night, and I hear this like huge like sound like this, whoosh, something like that, whoosh, and I was like, what the heck was that? I thought, it must be a car wreck. So I open up the door, and there is a white pickup truck out there, and I don't see any other cars around. So I wasn't sure. Well, it mustn't have been a car wreck. And here, there was a bunch of lumber in the middle of the street. I was like, what happened here? And the guy was like trying to put it all into the back of his pickup. So me being the nice guy I am, I went out there and helped him. And what happened was that he had been coming up this other street that goes right toward my place, but then, like I said, there's a stop sign there. He stopped, and then when he accelerated away from the stoplight, all of this lumber slid out the back of his truck. The tailgate was down there. They were these, like, 2x4x10s. How many of them? 70. 72x4x10s in the back of this pickup truck. And the pickup truck was like only an 8-foot bed, so you know the lumber sticking out the back of it. He had like a bed liner, you know, one of those black plastic bed liners in there. Well, it's, you know, those things can be a little slick. Every single one of those pieces of lumber slid out the back and ended up on the street. Every single, not one stayed in the bed. All 70 of them, whoosh, right out the back, and that sound I heard was them hitting the street. So over the course of like the next, I'm going to guess 7 minutes, something like that, myself and the guy driving the truck, an older guy. And then luckily two other guys stopped and helped. We finally got it all picked up and put it back in the bed of the truck, because as long as that lumber was there, no cars could pass. So there were cars backed up each way. It was just kind of funny. I even said to the guy, what are the odds? I mean, I can understand, you know, things are falling out of pickup trucks all the time. But what are the odds that every single piece of lumber slides out of your bed? So you can imagine 70 pieces of 2x4x10 lumber was a little bit of a stack. And that was a little bit of a workout. I have to tell you, it was a little bit of a workout putting that all back in there. But we got it done. And then the funny thing was that one of the other guys, I was walking back to my place, into my place, and they were all getting their cars. The one guy said to the owner of the lumber, he said, hope you have help getting all that, unloading all that. And he made a good point. If that guy was going to do it by himself, he was going to be there all day. He said he was building a garage or something. Just kind of a weird thing that happened out in front of my place. Just couldn't believe it. Every single piece of lumber out on the street. Let's get to the show. Neil Gorsuch, it seemed, had a pretty good day yesterday. I think the advantage that he has is that these senators, particularly, I guess in this case, it would be the Democrat senators, they don't know what they don't know. And this is something that I've talked about before. Congress thinking that it's a lawmaking body, as if it's a manufacturing center. Yes, that is where federal laws are started, created, and passed. Yes, it is. That doesn't mean it's supposed to be a manufacturing center. Like it is supposed to make laws, unlike Ford Motor Company or Apple or any of these companies that make stuff. They are in the job of making stuff. There's no law. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the Congress has to do anything. Those men and women could just sit there for their entire terms and not do anything. But I think what happens, and many of them do have law degrees, but although I'm not sure how many of them actually practice law. I mean, it seems like everybody goes to law school these days, doesn't it? And a lot of those people never end up practicing one day of law, which is very strange to me. I'd only go to school if it's going to be for something that I'm actually going to do. Otherwise, I'm not going. That's just me. But I think what happens is that all of these, both sides, and it just happens to be the Democrats in this case, because Neil Gorsuch was appointed by a Republican, is that I think because these people make laws all the time, that they automatically think that they know the law. They don't. They automatically think that they're lawyers. They aren't, some of them. They automatically think that they have the fullest understanding of how laws and justice is supposed to work in the United States. That's all wrong. It's all wrong. It's no different than a person who uses a computer. You can be very versed at using a computer, but that doesn't mean you know how to build one, you know how to program one or anything. You're just using stuff that other people have made. And that's kind of the way that I look at Congress. And it's on display every time you have one of these confirmation hearings with a judge. Somebody's going to make on the Supreme Court. All of these people on both sides think that they are experts on the law. And so we had yesterday, and that is to the nominee's advantage. All right, that's to the nominee's advantage. This is the exact reason, and yes, I am making fun of Republicans in this case, because it seems to me that they never quite are able to paint into a corner the Democrats, the Democrat nominees, for example, Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, when they were nominated between whatever the year, you know, between 2009 and 2016. They went up there and they were able to tiptoe through the tulips. Now, granted, they were probably going to get confirmed anyway because the Senate was in Democrat control. But you never saw any of those Republican senators, even Ted Cruz, really able to box those two women into a corner with their beliefs about the law. Why? Because really, even though they're liberal and wrong in many respects, truthfully, they do probably understand the law, and they have dealt with the law more than any of these senators have. But it's to the nominee's advantage that all of these senators have fooled themselves into thinking they know the law. That's an advantage. They're overconfident. They come up with these tricky little things that they're going to do to try to get Neil Gorsuch, paint him into a corner, and it never works. It's also the reason it doesn't work in the opposite case with a Democrat nominee and a Republican senator. So there was Al Franken up there. There was Dianne Feinstein, neither of whom have law degrees. But you know what? They're really good at making laws. They're really good at coming up with some bill or, you know, altering something and sponsoring a bill. They are the best in the world at that. And because of that, they think they know the law. They don't. They don't. And so Neil Gorsuch, you know, it was almost like kind of like if it was Roger Federer playing some amateur in tennis. You know, the amateur tennis player would deliver his best serve and, you know, Roger Federer would just hit it back and hit the line and the amateur has no shot whatsoever. Even if it's the best amateur tennis player in the world, would be hard-pressed to win even one game from Roger Federer and they could play 100. This is kind of what that felt like, at least what I saw the video of these back and forth between Al Franken and, you know, this crazy thing that somebody must allegedly, you know, the crazy allegation against Neil Gorsuch that he said that pregnant women shouldn't be lawyers or whatever that was. And he just outrightly pointed out how that came about, what he was talking about in the class. He brought up the book and everything else. Now, if he can do that, shouldn't the person or persons asking the questions about that be able to do that as well? Shouldn't they? You start to wonder why these senators would actually make themselves look like a little bit of idiots doing this. If, you know, they have these really, they think is a tough question, and then Neil Gorsuch just deflects it in a matter of seconds. You know, and that's why I continue to think that a lot of this is just for show. I think that we just should have the vote right now. This nomination and confirmation and this back and forth, it's all bread and circuses. It's all for the cameras. It's great drama. I don't know if it's technically good for the country. I don't know if constitutionally it's very good for the country at all. I don't know why we have to go through these procedures when we already know what's going to happen. Other than for these Democrat senators to cover their own butts, to say, well, you know what? We asked these questions. What are you going to do? The Republicans control the Senate, you know. That's all this is. And they might as well just – I would criticize Republicans. Just have the vote already. There is nothing in the Constitution – that says that this even, not any of this has to happen. None of it. All it says is that the president gets to appoint people with advice and consent from the Congress, and this is what it's turned into 200 some years later. This is what it's turned into. It's turned into a media, it turns into reality TV, it's turned into people who probably would rather, well, Frank, and he was an actor, of course, a comedian at one time, Saturday Night Live and elsewhere, their time to get some camera time and to show what they're doing for their constituents and how they're giving this Republican a hard time. But they know that the vote is already in. So let's just move on. This is, you know, we talk about waste in government. We talk about the waste of money, the waste of people and everything. This is a waste. It's a waste. They should have had the vote already. As soon as Neil Gorsuch was nominated, you give, I guess, them a couple days to look up his resume and his bio, and then just have the vote. Just do it. You know, and it's funny to me, and this is where I would have to criticize my fellow conservative media people, you know, saying that, you know, Dianne Feinstein and these people were out of line and everything. This is nothing. You know, what Neil Gorsuch has gone through so far, and I know he's continuing today, and I didn't have a chance to watch it or anything, but this is nothing compared to what Robert Bork had to go through. This is nothing compared to what Clarence Thomas had to go through. It's nothing. I mean, Neil Gorsuch, as far as I can remember, looked as calm as any Supreme Court nominee that I can remember. It seems to me. I'd say he was laughing, he was smiling, and I know he rolled his eyes at that question that Al Franken asked, but he didn't look worried at all. He didn't look stressed at all. I'm not saying he didn't have some butterflies. Obviously, it's a great opportunity for him. you know, being a judge, going into the profession of law, becoming a judge. This is as good as it gets. Being nominated to the Supreme Court is, I would say, a bigger deal than being Attorney General of the United States, I think. This is a big deal for him. So it'd be no different than a golfer that's in, you know, that's on the web.com tour or whatever, finally getting his cue card to play on the, you know, got enough points or won enough money on the web.com tour to play the real PGA tour for a year, or a golfer who finally wins a tournament, which means he gets to enter play the Masters for the first time. This is this is what this is for Neil Gorsuch. It's an opportunity of a lifetime to etch himself into American history. And in that, I think he was probably nervous. It's a great opportunity. But I do not think that any of these questions that came from Democrats yesterday worried him at all. Now, what's interesting to me, and you know I've been suspicious of Neil Gorsuch. I will continue to be, I think, because he did clerk for who? Anthony Kennedy, right? So we're not sure how that's all going to play into this eventually. We don't know. You don't really know what kind of judge you're going to get until he gets in there. You know, or I guess it's one of those Nancy Pelosi things. You have to confirm him before you find out how he's actually going to judge. I'm still going to be suspicious of that and watch that very closely. However, I will say that Neil Gorsuch, I'm feeling a little better, if only for one maybe trivial fact, and that he is a David Foster Wallace fan just like I am. If you don't know what I'm talking about, David Foster Wallace was an author who wrote the book Infinite Jest. I've not read it, but I do have listened to interviews with him over the years, and I did see his commencement speech, which really, for me, put him on the map for me. I think that was in 2005 that he did that, and you can find it online, and it's this speech called This Is Water, and it's fantastic. Fantastic. If you want to find out a different way to look at your life and what goes on in the world, it's a very good way. And it talks about, you know, going to school isn't necessarily about knowledge. It's about how to think and what you choose to think. It's fantastic. Well, it just so happens that in at least one of Neil Gorsuch's papers that he wrote, I don't know if it was technically a decision on a case or anything, but something maybe he wrote for a law magazine, I don't know. But he references David Foster Wallace and this idea of this is water. And the idea is this, at least in David Foster Wallace's speech, he talks about these two fish, and one fish says to the, you know, is going by, the older fish says to the younger fish, "Hey, how's the water?" And, you know, the old fish keeps swimming, and the two fish, younger fish, are sitting there. And the one says to the other, "What's water?" You know, and it's something, you are so immersed in something, I guess a fish literally in water, you are so immersed in something, you don't even know that it exists. Mm-hmm. And you don't even realize, you just take it for granted so much that you don't realize that something you're taking for granted is actually a choice. It's very, very, it's very profound, and I urge it. It's like a 20-minute commencement speech that you can find in YouTube. Well, Neil Gorsuch used that same analogy in a writing of his about how the law and how it permeates our lives. It is so woven into American culture that you don't even know it exists. That we don't realize that the reason we have the country we do is because of the law. And that's, I guess it goes back to the idea, this is a country of laws, not a country of men. And although we may not be every day are we're thinking about the law, it still plays a huge, huge part in our lives, from what we own, what we can say, what we can, how we are allowed to worship, what we are allowed to write, all sorts of things. You know, and of course, the law in the United States is supposed to be based on protecting those rights. But we get so caught up in that we kind of forget about the law itself. But it's something that's like this invisible thing that is woven through all of us. And we just take it for granted so much, we almost forget about it. Just like fish are so immersed in the water that at some point they even forget to see it anymore. They forget that it's that which keeps them alive. And so Neil Gorsuch used this analogy in one of his writings, and I think that's pretty profound. And so just that little bit right there gets him into my little graces. My grace is probably about 1% more. So that's an interesting part. And I have to admit that I was not the person who came upon that. I think that was something that Kevin Williamson at National Review pointed out yesterday on National Review, the website, that it turns out that Neil Gorsuch is a David Foster Wallace fan. I don't think that – I think, as I said yesterday, I think that this is going to continue to be a confirmation hearing that has a couple interesting points, little interesting exchanges and everything, but I think that all of this has already been decided. You know, unless it comes out that Neil Gorsuch in his basement at home has Nazi memorabilia and worships Adolf Hitler every night, I think that he's going to get confirmed. It's going to be along long party lines, and that'll be that. And he will be the next justice of the Supreme Court. And then we'll get to start judging him on the choices that he makes. But I so far, I think he's doing a very, very fine job. Let's move on to something else. Donald Trump has issued, I don't know if it was a few days ago now, but I think that this has been his attitude since the beginning, that it's past Trump care or else. That for this bill that has been written, now it's been altered, I guess, some, but not that much, in the House, that unless these Republicans who are not for it, who aren't going to vote for it, both in the House and the Senate, unless they want to be primaried, then they better vote for it. They will pay the cost. It's vote for Trump care or else. That, I think, is a bet I would take up with Donald Trump. Now, if I was a politician, I don't know. Let's just say I was serving in the district. I was serving in the district in the House where I live right now. You should know something. Maybe I've forgotten to remind you this. Do you know who my representative is? And keep in mind, I live in Madeira Beach, Florida, which is in Pinellas County. It's the same county where St. Petersburg and Clearwater are. This is the district. The county is essentially the district. My representative is Charlie Crist. Is that funny or what? That guy just will not go away. Just will not go on his merry way. But it was David Jolly. And in this election, I think that this was one of the few districts in the United States that was Republican and went to Democrat while Donald Trump was winning the presidency. One of the few. But I live here. And it is a very purplish district. Back then it voted for George W. Bush twice, but then it voted for Barack Obama twice. And really, regarding Donald Trump, I'm not sure which way it went. Now I have to look into that. Or if I knew it, I forgot. But Charlie Crist won, probably on the benefit of name recognition alone, being that he was governor of the state, and now he's the representative of some little tiny county. Just These people, they just don't want to leave politics. But even me, as a conservative, if I would have won here in Pinellas County in 2016, I was running the same exact day Donald Trump was running. And I was exactly the same person you hear here. H-E-A-R and then H-E-R-E. I would take him up on that bet. I think that I would know this county enough, representing it, having campaigned here and gone from town to town, event to event, going from the north part of the Pinellas County down to the south. If you don't know, it's kind of a long north and south county, but very skinny east to west. It's, I don't know, 50 miles. It's like 50 miles north to south, but it's probably only about 10 miles east to west. It looks like that, if you don't know. But from the north to the south, the east to the west, divide them into these events, and I won, let's say, decently comfortably in 2016. Let's say I won 55% to 45%, something like that. His threat, Donald Trump's threat, would not faze me at all. I would like to think that as a representative of Pinellas County, of whatever distance, this District 12, I think it is, I think I would be able to make the sales pitch that is much better than what Donald Trump is selling. I think I would. And I happen to know that a lot of these people who are opposing Trump care in the House, whether it's the representatives themselves or people in the House who are already, or in the Senate who are already saying, no, that's not going to happen, like Mike Lee and like Ted Cruz, they are in states or districts where they're probably even more popular than I would be in Pinellas County in Florida. So I think that this threat is going to come upon deaf ears. I think that now they may end up voting for it anyway, unfortunately, but I don't think it'll be because of that. I don't think it's going to be because they're afraid of Donald Trump or they're afraid of getting primaried or anything else. But it does show something else. This is one more reason. This is one more sign that I've told you. Donald Trump is not conservative. Because I realize there are representatives and a couple senators who have said they won't vote for it for the totally opposite reason that, you know, this bill goes too far, which is crazy. Most of the opposition to this bill is because it doesn't go far enough to rebuilding Obamacare. Why would Donald Trump ever threaten a bunch of conservatives who even more want to dismantle Obamacare, while Donald Trump said that he wants to do that exact, who said he wants to do that exact thing while he was campaigning? Why would he then threaten those people who were just going by what he said? The conclusion that I come to once again is that he's not conservative. I want to know something. Are we ever going to see a time where Donald Trump comes out and criticizes the more liberal wing of the Republican Party? Is that ever going to happen? Where a bill that is somewhat conservative goes in and he tells those liberals, if you don't go with me, I'm going to primary you. No, instead, what has he done? Even on an issue such as immigration, where there are liberal factions, I guess you'd call them liberal factions, who are not for the wall, who are for the DREAM Act and everything else. What has he ever threatened them since he's been president? No, he's done the exact opposite. He's backed off his claim that Mexico is going to pay for the wall. He's entertaining the idea of allowing all of those dreamers to stay here. He gives in to the liberal side of the Republican Party within seconds of becoming president. But then on something like Obamacare and the repealing of it, he doesn't give in to the conservatives. He doesn't come out and say, you know what? I think this bill doesn't go far enough. It doesn't. These conservatives are right. It doesn't go far enough. No, he turns around and criticizes them. This is one more way I've tried to tell you. He is not conservative. He is going to bash conservatives every time he has a chance because he's not one. He's a knee-jerk liberal. And this is why this is going on. This is why he's threatening to primary these conservatives. Because in the end, he doesn't like conservatism. I don't know what else to tell you. I got to go to the break. You've been listening to America's Conservative Podcast.
The voice of American conservatism. WRS Digital. Red State Talk Radio.
And we are back at America's Conservative Podcast. Just in the time I stopped the recording to take that break, I emailed off to my buddy Dave that exact point I just made to you before the break, that sure does seem that I don't hear anything coming out of the Trump White House where he's threatened liberal Republicans that he's going to primary that over anything. But he's surely going to primary conservative Republicans over things. Very, very interesting. I wonder. You know, I forgot to mention something. I'm looking here at my notes regarding Neil Gorsuch. I need to add this into this. And I gave the example that, you know, the advantage that Neil Gorsuch had is that all these Democrat senators think they're all really lawyers and they're experts on the law, and that it's what they don't know. They think they know everything. It's what they don't know that actually hurts them in any of these questioning of any of these judges that come up for hearings. I thought of back to John Yoo. You know, he's a guy, he's a law professor at Berkeley. He's a conservative, served in the Bush White House. And he is one of the two guys who appears, one of the three guys technically, who appears on Law Talk, which is one of my favorite political podcasts out there that plays on Ricochet.com. He appeared on Jon Stewart's show on Comedy Central once, going back several years. I'm going to say maybe 2011, maybe even further back than that. And afterwards, he was asked about that, and he said, well, you know, because he went on there, and Jon Stewart couldn't lay a finger on John Yoo. Not a finger. And it was all about torture and whether waterboarding is torture and the torture memos, because John Yoo was a big part of that during the George W. Bush years. And Jon Stewart, being the smug, arrogant, self-assured, unself-aware guy that he is, thought he was going to be able to get Jon Stewart on there, John Yoo on there, and make an idiot of him. But obviously, I mean, it was obvious. John Yoo just totally turned the tables on Jon Stewart. So he was asked afterwards, I think actually on the podcast, how did you do that? And he said, simple. I just treat Jon Stewart just like I treat any of my students who think that they know more than I do. I treat him the exact same way. Every student comes into his class that, you know, they're in a very exclusive law school. You have to be a very good student, despite what you might think of Berkeley otherwise. But they all are all straight A's, top of their class people. They go in there, they think they know everything, and then it's John Yoo's job to show them they don't know anything. And that's all he did there. And so it is Jon Stewart's ego and vanity and lack of self-awareness and know-it-allism that actually technically gets him in trouble when it comes to talking to somebody who is actually smarter and knows their stuff. This is what's going on with Neil Gorsuch and all these senators. And like I said, I'm not trying to be a partisan here. I feel the same way about it in the opposite with Kagan and Sotomayor. Those senators, the Republican senators, they didn't lay a finger on them either. And that should tell you something. So I just saw that. I didn't want to forget that because John Yoo, I got to meet John Yoo on National Review Cruise 2012. Seems like it was yesterday. Good guy. I remember he was sitting behind me at one of these conferences, these, you know, get-togethers, these events that they have during the cruise. He was sitting there, he had his laptop out just typing stuff. You know, he's in his bare feet and shorts and a t-shirt just hanging out. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Let's move on to something else. The NEA, National Endowment for the Arts. This has become a topic again because there are cuts coming to that. In fact, the belief is that, you know, this budget that came out of the Trump White House, what was it, a week ago now, however long it was, completely cuts funding for that and many other, I guess, liberal departments, the departments of the federal government that turn out liberal ideas and liberal products and liberal services. You know my attitude. I could put up with the NEA if we could get entitlements under control. But, you know, even though I don't like the NEA, I think that the government has no reason to be in the arts business, except to make sure that people who create art on their own are protected by the laws, their rights are protected, their property is protected. That's it. That's my attitude. And I think it would be hard to say that if we get rid of the National Endowment for the Arts, that entertainment and the artistic pursuits in the United States are suddenly going to disappear. That is just not the case. And the NEA, and of course I think of the National Education Association, but the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, makes up what percentage of it could be for the total amount of private money spent on artistic pursuits, movies, books, radio, podcasting, writing, drawing, painting, everything else put together. How much of that is actually the NEA's work? It has to be less than 1%. Has to be, given how huge the entertainment industry is in the United States. You got to remember something. We talk about manufacturing and how these other countries don't treat the United States fair and everything else. An industry that could really, really be hurt by trade barriers and trade wars and everything is the entertainment industry. Why? America's greatest export is entertainment. In fact, it's not even close. It's not weapons. It's not helicopters and jets and stuff that we sell and guns that we sell to our allies or anything like that. It's certainly not cars. It's not services. Nothing. The biggest export we have is entertainment. And virtually all of it is private entertainment brought up by private individuals or corporations, people working on their own, creating things. That is an industry that probably would be hurt quite a bit if we got into some trade war with China or any of these other countries. Because the way it is today, especially in the movie business, is that Hollywood now, the reason these budgets on these movies can continue to go up, 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 is because the market of China is now completely open. And already we know that Hollywood worries about piracy. That, you know, as soon as a movie comes out, you can find it online. Most of that comes from China. But still, they put up with that because still the Chinese market is still so huge. A market that was not available to entertainment companies, film companies 25 years ago. Companies can now, movies can now make a lot more money because of that market. More people too, more eyeballs, just frankly put. That could go away if some sort of trade war starts between the United States and China. Remember that. In fact, I would say that would be the industry that would be affected the most. We just don't think about that. But getting back to the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, it's weird to me. I have to say that it's weird to me that Democrats protect this. And, of course, they tried it out, Big Bird and all of this stuff, all these characters that have been created by PBS over the years. And to me, government-sponsored art is weird. I have to admit that when I start thinking about artists working and taking a government check, to do whatever they're going to do is weird. And it doesn't even have to do be what the result is. There was an excellent article a few days ago. I don't know if it was on Red State or what it was, but made the point of saying it is not, we as conservatives, we are not opposed to the National Endowment for the Arts because of some of the crap that has come out of the National Endowment for the Arts over the years. That is not the reason. That's not the reason. The reason is that government shouldn't be involved in art in the first place, period. Now, if you want to take that further, and actually I wrote about this in my GovaSite series, a book series that I don't mention too, but it's out there. You can find it on Amazon. You can download it to your Kindle, just as easy as ever. But I talk about this in those books. I says, I guess primarily the first and second book. The government-sponsored art, where an artist is getting paid by the government to make something, will quickly become government-approved art. Meaning that it is art that only portrays government or whatever else, connected taxes or whatever else, only in a positive way. Regulations in a positive way. That's eventually what it all becomes. It doesn't have anything to do with whether a statue of Jesus is dumped in urine, which is the thing that conservatives think of first when they start thinking about the National Endowment for the Arts. And that was years and years. I think that happened when I was in college, or maybe even in the 80s, something crazy, you know, going back that far. It seems like yesterday, but that's a well-known story. That was something that was paid for, but with government money. It's not that. It's that we as conservatives, we don't like the idea of government-approved art, especially in a country where we are supposed to have free speech. And if we are to accept that artistry is an expression of free speech, now, because as a conservative, I have no problem. If somebody wants to put Jesus in urine, I know that's foul, F-O-U-L, not F-I-L-E, foul. And as a Christian, kind of a Christian, I'm, you know, not disgusted by that, but it seems wrong to me. But if that's what that guy wants to do with his time, I don't know what you can do about that. I don't know what you can do. But when government gets involved, and it's people's tax dollars, and the National Endowment for the Arts exists to patronize the arts, seems like a very questionable spending of government money. But I would say that about anything. And so we can't just be painted into this corner, because then eventually liberals are going to say, well, would it, you find it okay if somebody painted the Mona Lisa with government money? Huh? Would you still be arguing about it now then? And it's a tough position to take, but my attitude would still be, yeah, it's still wrong. Yes, it's still wrong. Now, and I've read this before, not recently, because, you know, I have to admit that arguing about the National Endowment of the Arts and government money going into art projects is not a common topic out there. I think the closest we get to it, maybe on a yearly basis, is we hear about states that are giving tax deductions and tax breaks to film companies that come to their states, and which is a whole other topic, a good topic, but I'm just not in favor of that either, but it's a little bit of a separate topic. That's what I think it's a more common thing that people think of. But I would issue the example of Shakespeare, that going back to the 1500s, that even though we know that he was paid by the king and was commissioned to write a play or whatever else, the fact is, if the king didn't like what Shakespeare wrote, didn't get paid. Didn't get paid. There was still a kind of a market force at work there. Whereas it seems what's the problem, one of the problems with the National Endowment for the Arts is I think that these people get paid up front and they don't have to give the money back no matter what they produce. And in a country where we have so many people writing, painting, filming movies, using their own personal cameras, of course, with the internet, with YouTube and Instagram and Snapchat, and all of these different ways that you can now tell stories, people even writing novels that appear on Twitter, they write the novel 140 characters at a time. It certainly does seem weird that government is still in the arts business, no matter what the product is that's being put out. It certainly seems strange. I believe when it comes to the arts, that a person has the right to do what, you know, whatever they want, as long as nobody's being injured, as long as nobody's being forced to do anything against their will. And this is the reason that I know probably I'm in a minority when it comes to pornography. As long as the women and men are there by their own choice, I have no problem with it. If there's sex trafficking going on and women or men are being forced to do things, then of course it's wrong. It's illegal, and anybody involved with it should be put in jail. That's how I feel about it. And same way I feel like if you want to call stripping, strip clubs, exotic dancers, if you want to call that some sort of art form, I feel the same way. That federally, I believe that is an artistic pursuit, and people should be allowed to do it. I know that there are local laws against it, and that's something different. But I do believe that in those cases, it is a freedom of speech issue. Unless, once again, these women are being forced into prostitution or they're acting against local laws regarding prostitution, all of that stuff. It's just weird after all these decades, we're still talking about the National Endowment for the Arts when more than ever, people can easily get paid for their artistic pursuits on YouTube and elsewhere if they open up a Patreon account or anything like that. There's plenty of ways that artists that want to do that type of thing, and I even know this from all the podcasting that I do, that if you want to make money podcasting and you want to make money right from day one, you just open up a Patreon account and you ask your listeners to contribute. Business-wise, see nothing wrong. I don't do it for my own personal beliefs about what I do. I have a different attitude toward it, but there's certainly nothing wrong, illegal, or moral, or anything else against that. I just have a different idea of how I conduct my shows, and how I like to think that I have a different relationship with my listeners than that. So, once again, it's still hard for me to believe that we still devote any money to this. It feels outmoded. It feels like the Pony Express. That something that day was here, and now technology and time and the culture and everything have just completely wiped it away. It's not relevant anymore. And I don't even know if it was relevant when it started, but it's surely not relevant now. So I'm warning you as conservatives, I would not default to the Jesus in urine defense every time this subject comes up. I think that you have to make a little more structured argument than that and make sure you're making an argument that includes the idea that no matter what is turned out with government money for the arts, that it's all bad and shouldn't be done. Not just the bad stuff, the quote-unquote bad stuff that offends you personally. This goes more than your personal taste. I know that's a little difficult. You're going to be challenged on that. But that's the only particularly correct position. I know for me personally, when I think about, I think about Hitler. I think about Nazi Germany. I think about East Germany. I think about the Soviet Union. I think about North Korea. I think about China. I think about all of the arts that our government that were financed in those countries or continue, being that some of them, those countries still exist, where money was devoted to the arts. That's what I think of. Even though I know that our country is much different, our government is much different, our attitude toward rights and everything is much different, when I think about government paying for the arts and commissioning artists, you know, with taxpayer money, I automatically default to all of that. Now, what's interesting about that is that Adolf Hitler, for example, was a huge Wagner fan. Flight of the Valkyries, or dun, 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 you know that song. And he expressed frustration during his time as leader of Germany in those, how many it was, about 12 years, whatever it was, that no true artistry, lasting artistry, was created during that time. He was frustrated that there was no music or anything that rose to the level of Wagner. He couldn't understand that, given all of the German pride that he created, pride in Germany, Germany's the best country in the world, the best country in existence, and still nothing was ever created during that time, no matter how much money the Nazi government sunk into it, because they had many artistic pursuits financed. Of course, we know Triumph of the Will, that documentary, and bunches of things. Can you name one Nazi musician? Name one Nazi writer who wrote novels? Name one Nazi, a German and Nazi. The best book that was written during the time that Nazi Germany existed was The Diary of Anne Frank, and she was Jewish, and she was trying to avoid the Nazis. That's the best book that was written, and it was a darn good one. You know, her story. Now, why liberals don't see that? They don't see that the best kind of artistry, usually that's written, is the kind that is opposing government, not being financed by it, is beyond me. I guess you could talk about Solzhenitsyn and some other Russian writers who worked under the Soviet Union and what they had to go through, the persecution they got. But they were writing against, those were the best books written, the ones that were opposing the Soviet Union. And now here in the United States, we have a bunch of people who think that government should be financing writers and artists and movie makers. It's crazy. One more thing before I go. When did this flat earth thing become a thing again? I didn't know that there was still a debate out there about this. I don't know if this is a sham. I don't know if this is fake news, some sort of, you know, just trying to, you know, get it, somebody trying to get attention for their website. But there was an NBA player, Kyrie Irving. I don't watch the NBA at all. But he made some statement about how the Earth's flat. And now Shaquille O'Neal, a guy who I'm much more familiar with, has said that he also believes that the Earth is flat. And he talked about driving many times from California to Texas or wherever it was, and it sure does seem flat to me. Is this real? I can understand, you know, there are people out there who still don't believe we landed on the moon. I don't know what you can do about that. But when you take it to the point that the Earth is actually flat and it's not round, it's not like a baseball, that is completely crazy, and it shouldn't surprise us given the state of how we teach science in the United States and the world these days. But I gotta go. Maybe we'll talk about that again some other time. You can email me, EdwardDentzelReagan.com. Follow me on Twitter, USA Podcast. My other show, Unfound, gonna be a great episode this week, two-parter this week and next week. You can find that show at Podomatic and iTunes. Please subscribe, share, and review. I gotta go. You've been listening to America's Conservative Podcast.